Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakraborty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. In the news this week, it was a game of chicken on Beacon Hill, dueling Democrats and dueling visions of the future and how much to tax and spend.
I am not willing to ask the people of the Commonwealth to pay more and get less.
Also this week, another round of debates in the race for the U.S. Senate. The two Democrats, Congressman Ed Markey and Stephen Lynch, sparred over abortion rights, gay marriage, and Obamacare.
Every single Republican voted no on that bill. Steve voted no on that bill.
And the three Republicans engaged in their most heated debate yet.
I'm not going to do something just because it feels good.
So you'd be voting no.
This is exactly what happens when politicians don't answer the question.
And the Boston mayor's race gets even more crowded.
I'm running for mayor of Boston because I think it's the best job in the world.
And it's hard to define what type of mayor I'm going to be.
I am a son of Boston. I love my city.
I'm just excited to get going here.
And joining us now to dig into the big local stories of this past week is Scott Lehigh, columnist for the Boston Globe. Hey, Scott.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Also with us is Julie Mahegan, Deputy Editorial Page Editor for the Boston Herald. Julie, good to see you again.
Hello, everybody.
So let's start today, everyone, if we can, with transportation and the debate on Beacon Hill over the taxes that would come along with supporting the various transportation plans. As you know, Governor Deval Patrick had a $1.9 billion plan that would support transportation and education. The House, however, approved a $500 million plan of its own this week that Speaker Robert DeLeo calls a better solution for Massachusetts. Here he is.
What this plan does actually is to make sure that those who would be hardest hit by the taxes that the governor is talking about, they are not.
That's Robert DeLeo speaking from the marbled and echoey halls of Beacon Hill. Governor Deval Patrick, however, called the speaker's plan, quote, a pretend solution. And he, however, may be warming to a proposal from the Senate side that would raise more than $880 million in additional revenue. Here's Senate President Therese Murray on that plan.
Hopefully, when it goes to the governor, he will not veto it, because we need to know how much revenues we have from this bill in order to really put our budgets together.
Julie, let's start with you. This isn't the first time we've seen the various Democratic leadership aspects of the Democratic leadership argue against each other here. What do you make of this disagreement between the three Beacon Hill leaders?
Well, it's not the first time, but it is a little surprising in that this is the seventh year of Deval Patrick's administration, and it strikes me, I don't have any inside information, but it strikes me, and I think strikes a lot of people, that he didn't really sell this plan to legislative leaders before he began a massive campaign of selling it to the public. And that, I think, was sort of a real strategic error. And, you know, I think anybody who has covered the State House and covered Bob DeLeo and Terry Murray knows that you know, they like to be informed. They like to be involved along the way. From many accounts, they told the governor that an income tax was really just not going to fly, and he decided that he would take a gamble on it anyway.
Well, on that note, Scott, let me ask you. You wrote a column this week titled "Lesson for a Lame Duck." That lame duck, of course, being Governor Patrick, because he's not running again. What are those lessons that you think he should learn?
Well, I think one of them is that you have to have a some sense of the size of the canvas you're painting on here. And these guys clearly had no appetite for something this large. The Speaker had told him before. At least according to sources I have, that look, I don't think I can do anything in the income tax. I believe I could do something in the gas tax, maybe get some other revenues. The governor then, when he did his State of the State and he came out with this gargantuan plan. I mean, this is a very big plan and a very big tax hike and a very complex rewriting of the tax code in Massachusetts. And afterward, I happened to be out there, you know, gathering quotes in the hall from the Speaker and the Senate President, and both of them said, "We got this when you guys got this. We had no idea."
I mean, so they really felt caught off guard.
Took them completely off guard. And it might be something if you're talking about, you know, passing the Disposable Coffee Cup Act to take them completely off guard. But on something this large, it's just political malpractice to have done that.
Well, on that note, sorry, Julie, but one more question before we move on. We've got two bookends regarding the scope of a plan, $500 million from the House, $1.9 from Governor Patrick. The Senate comes in roughly in the middle at $880 million. Do you think that is the viable way forward politically on Beacon Hill?
Well, it certainly looks as if that's where the Senate is going. The open question is whether the House will go along. I think you could make a case that they will. I thought it was interesting that the governor, What struck me is softening his tone a little bit when the Senate came out with that plan, and he sort of said, well, you know, I would like to get to agreement. But then he said, we have to see if the Senate numbers are real, and if not, it's just kicking the can down the road. Hmm. So he really is not really, he's not really backing off of his rhetoric, at least, and as to whether he'll back off the broader scope of the plan.
Scott, your thought on that?
I think he'll have to. I mean, I think, honestly, he's in a situation where he bluffed. They essentially are, I think, are going to call his bluff, and I think he's going to have to step down on the veto threat, and I believe he will say, okay, this gives me, you know, a portion of what I want, and it's a good faith effort. I think he will soften the rhetoric. I think that's about the only choice left to him, because he's in a situation where it could be where he vetoes it, they don't override, the thing is dead, and nothing gets done, he gets nothing. Mm. So I don't think he's got an awful lot of options left here, honestly.
And that's real, by the way. I mean, I really feel, I think Brian Dempsey and others have made it clear that if we can't override a veto, it's not coming up again. So it's all or nothing at this point.
Well, let's move on to the race for the U.S. Senate in Massachusetts. With just about 2 weeks to go to the primary, both Democrats and all three Republicans debated again this week. Let's start with the Democrats. Congressman Steve Lynch and Ed Markey squared off at UMass Lowell Monday night. Here's Steve Lynch, the former iron worker from South Boston, making his case that he'd represent a needed change in the Senate, which he called an elite club.
I'm not saying that every U.S. senator should have stood in an unemployment line. I'm not saying that every U.S. senator should have, you know, struggled through night school to get a degree. I'm just saying one U.S. senator should have had that experience and bring that perspective to the United States Senate on behalf of you all.
And Scott and Julie, let me start with this point that Steve Lynch is making. And Scott, I'll start with you. Is this a good argument that he could sort of crash the party of the Senate Millionaires Club?
No. No, I think it's a bad argument. I think it's kind of a tinny argument. I don't think it's a really horribly smart argument. It's an argument that says biography is destiny. I'm a working class guy, and I've had a school of hard knocks. But at this point, it's all about Steve Lynch. Translate that. What does that mean, Steve Lynch? What are you going to do for us? What does that mean when you say what policies, other than just being kind of more or less a robot for the building trades, what are you going to do down there? And you ask him that, and what you get is, well, I'll look at that, I'll look at this, I'll look at that. And he's contorted himself on some of the issues in a way that frankly, it's pretzel logic. So I think a campaign that's just all about Steve Lynch's humble roots is frankly, completely boring, issue non-specific, and it's just sputtering around as far as I'm concerned.
Julie, Scott has a pretty firm point of view there. What's yours?
Well, I should just start out by saying, in the interest of full disclosure, the Herald editorial page where I work came out with our endorsements this week. We did endorse Steve Lynch for the Democrats and Dan Winslow for the Republicans. So just
good. Well,
just
tell us why.
Put that out there. Well, I think if you want to take sort of the flip side of the argument that Scott makes, it's not, I think that Lynch would argue, perhaps, that it's not just about biography, but it's about this sort of sense of independence that independent-mindedness that he might bring to the Senate. I think that's sort of an effort to appeal to some of those Scott Brown-type voters out there, which, you know, worked for Scott Brown once, and I think maybe Lynch, you know, he makes a point of saying, you know, he doesn't publicize or at least celebrate the fact that he voted against Obamacare, because a lot of Democratic primary voters certainly wouldn't mm-hmm. be appreciative of that. But he defends it, I think, in many ways by arguing that it wasn't good for Massachusetts, and I'm willing to stand up and take votes, take tough votes if I don't think that they're, and votes against my leadership when it's not good for my state.
Well, let's hear Ed Markey on that, because he, in fact, takes Steve Lynch to task for voting against the Affordable Care Act. Let's listen.
The only option when we were voting was an option to vote for that bill that ensured that every child had health care, to make sure that being a woman was no longer a pre-existing condition, to make sure that there was prescription drug benefits for senior citizens in our country. Every single Republican voted no on that bill. Steve voted no on that bill.
Now, Scott, what do you think of this case? I mean, I find it curious that Lynch, arguably a lot more conservative than Markey on many issues, attacks Obamacare from the left, essentially. I don't know.
Well, he attacks it from the left and he attacks it from the right. I mean, I honestly got to say, I find his arguments on that preposterous, too. I think that my colleague, now Globe editor Brian McGrory, nailed that in a column right after the vote where he said Steve Lynch is for against the bill. I mean, he was trying to have it both ways. On the one hand, he said there was no public option. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, he said
there was a giveaway to the insurance
industry. Well, he said that, but they also were taxing, remember, some of the Cadillac health care plans that labor had. So I think he was just looking. I think Julie's right. He wanted to be Scott Brown. He was looking for ways to be against it. I think he's looking always for ways to kind of be a populist and kind of identify with a little guy and also sort of cover his butt, not have to take a vote that he, at that point, Obamacare wasn't awfully popular. And I think he thought, hey, I can position myself here and appeal in some way to both sides, which he seems to try to do quite a bit. I think, Marky, I mean, Obamacare has a lot of problems, and I think as it works through, people are going to see there are some real issues with it. Overall, keeping it in perspective, I think Marky was right. This is the one time this country has had in an awful long time to do something serious on health care, and this was the vote. And so if you think it's worth doing, even with all the problems, you voted yes, and if you were looking for ways to, you know, kind of stay politically viable or have it both ways, you voted no. And I think that, honestly, I think that's pretty clearly what Steve Lynch did on this.
Well, let's move on to the Republican side. The three Republican state rep Dan Winslow, former U.S. Attorney Michael Sullivan, and businessman Gabriel Gomez all debated this week as well. The economy came up, but they also talked about a lot of other things, including immigration reform and gun control. Here's Dan Winslow pressing Michael Sullivan on whether or not he'd vote to close the gun show loophole by expanding background checks.
You're in the U.S. Senate. How would you vote on the compromise?
It doesn't address the problem. I'm not going to do something just because it feels good.
So you'd be voting no.
So Winslow and former Navy SEAL Gabriel Gomez both support the proposal, but Sullivan didn't want to answer that question. Julie, what do you think? Our most recent poll about 10 days ago showed that many voters still don't know a lot about these guys. How do you see this race shaping up?
Well, Scott and I were talking before. I think maybe in some ways people have had a little bit of election fatigue into this.
Or a lot.
Even though those of us who do this for a living sort of thought, wow, we have another one of these to cover. And I think the Republicans always have a little bit more trouble kind of fighting for the headlines and the airwaves in a state like Massachusetts. So I think I don't remember the exact numbers in your poll most recently, but I'd be curious to know what the undecided numbers were.
They were high, yeah. And it was about 10 days ago, and I hesitate to pull them out of my head, but they were really, really high.
And I actually wouldn't be shocked even now with only 2 weeks to go before the election if they weren't still fairly high, because there have been a couple of great debates and some great coverage of this, but I'm just not sure if people have arrived at that decision.
Scott, what's your take on where the Republican side of this race is?
Well, I think this is a hugely interesting race in this way. Dan Winslow has positioned himself, I think, very clearly as the kind of the Bill Weld Republican, mm-hmm. the profile. He's libertarian / liberal. It translates almost to the same thing here. On the social issues like abortion and gay marriage, and he is a fiscal conservative, but not ultra conservative. So that's kind of that's a profile the state has been comfortable with in governors like Weld and Paul Cellucci and Jane Swift. Sullivan is running much more as a traditional conservative, although he's trying, I think, in many ways to fuzz that up a little bit. Gomez somewhere between them. Now the state Republicans have to make a decision what they do here. Do we sort of go with our id, which is to say the person who is really conservative and might be the way we honestly feel? Do we go with someone who's much more the profile of someone who can appeal to independents and have a real shot in this race? And I personally look at Winslow as a guy who could give Markey a run for the money. I'm much less sure about Sullivan, but I think the Republican electorate probably is a little closer to a Sullivan perspective. So I think the last couple of weeks will be interesting. And I think you're you're watching Winslow try to draw that differentiation. Now, it seems to me Sullivan is trying to sort of consolidate the more conservative part of the field because he's going after Gomez, saying you wrote this letter to Patrick,
that's right,
wanting to be our senator. You really, that should disqualify you, essentially, is what he's saying. He wants all that. But if the conservative field gets divided, I don't think it's out of the question that Winslow could squeak through on this one.
Did you say the Republican Party is wondering if it should go with its id?
Well, I mean, what it really
who's the super ego and ego in this race?
Well, that's it's kind of what's our real gut. I mean, here, I mean, it's kind of gut instinct as opposed to making a strategic decision. Who do we really think? Who do we honestly believe could win this race? I mean, remember, Steve Pierce was the favorite for a while, and then Weld came in and swamped it because all the independent women came into the race in 1990, and Weld was a very popular governor. That's the profile you have to have if you're going to be elected statewide as a Republican. That really is not Mike Sullivan's profile. It doesn't seem to be Gabriel Gomez's profile, although it's a little harder to say with him. That kind of is the Dan Winslow profile. Mm-hmm. So it's a tough decision, I would think, if you're a Republican.
It's a persistent problem in terms of the Republican Party in the state. But in the last minute or so that we've got, let's turn briefly to the mayoral race in Boston. Lots of new candidates entering that field this week, including Bill Walczak, community organizer, and then Boston City Councilor Felix Arroyo. Marty Walsh came. Michael Ross, city councilor, also. They joined John Connolly, Rob Consalvo, and Suffolk DA Dan Connolly. So lots of new names. Julie, let me just ask you, though, my basic question for this week, because there will be many weeks to talk about this, is no women yet.
Well, you know, I was thinking about this, and I was thinking, you know, in those of us who do this for a living, who cover these races and comment on them and everything else, we tend to go immediately to these boxes, right? So there's a mayoral race. The mayor just announces he's not running. So immediately those of us who cover it say, well, who's going to be the black candidate? Who's going to be the Latino candidate? Where is the woman? And, you know, I think these things have a way of kind of sorting themselves out. The field, obviously, every day we're getting more and more people in it. I do think it's noteworthy that there aren't any women yet, mm-hmm. although I think we reported today that Ayanna Pressley, the city councilor, is still considering getting into the race. And, you know, in 2005, Maura Hennigan gave Tom Menino a pretty spirited, I mean, the end result wasn't too close, but she gave him a pretty spirited campaign. So it's not as if we are searching for the first person ever to do this. And
just the first woman this time around. Scott, we've just got a little bit of time. I wonder what your brief thought is.
Women seem to be willing to take the risk when it's a long shot. I mean, Peggy Davis Mullen ran against Menino, and Moore Hennigan ran against him. And then when it's an open field, the cautious players get in, and that is much more the men in this case. My feeling right now is if you happen to be named Connolly and you're from Hyde Park, this is a very exciting race for you because you've got two namesakes to choose from.
Well, I was rushing us along because I did want to leave us just enough time to do our hubbubs for this week. Anthony, you want to start?
Yeah, mine's sort of a somber one, but it's a very, very touching one. The Boston Marathon on Monday, I just wanted to give a shout out to the Newtown Strong team. 9 runners from Newtown, Connecticut will be running on Monday. These 9 runners qualified for the race are going to be running all 26 miles, dedicating each mile of the 26 miles to the 26 victims at Sandy Hook, the 20 first graders and 6 staff members. And you know, I'm thinking of them. It's going to be a great day, and I think it's a really worthy cause that they're going to be running for.
On Monday.
On indeed. Monday.
Julie, your hubbub.
Well, mine's on a lighter note. I just wanted to give some credit and praise to the Riverhawks of the UMass, University of Massachusetts Lowell, the men's hockey team, which skated to the Final Four in Pittsburgh last night. They lost to Yale. It was a heartbreaker in overtime. But I spent about 5 years of my life working up in Lowell, and I have a great affection for the city, and I think the performance of the team brought a lot of credit to the university and to the city. It was great for school spirit and city pride, and I just wanted to give them some. We're used to the BUs and the BCs, right, everybody else getting to that level, but for UMass Lowell, it was a first, and it was great.
Frozen Four is nothing to be ashamed of.
Absolutely.
At all. Scott, your hubbub.
As we're doing all this debating over the transportation bill and the budget, it comes out that, at least if you can believe the different representations of it, that the governor has not spoken with the legislative leaders in the last 3 weeks, which is extraordinary for that to happen, and particularly at a time, you know, when all you got so many balls in the air.
Wow. Well, I'm going to round out today with my hubbub, and that has to do with the National Spelling Bee, because as if it weren't hard enough to spell some of the words that those bright young things have to spell, like cymotricus. Anyone want to take a stab at that one?
Does it start with a P?
No, it starts with a C, actually. Now you actually also have to know the definitions. They're adding a definition section to this, the spelling bee, so there'll be a test in advance. There were many words are listed, and the students have to know the definition. By the way, cymotricus means having wavy hair.
Of course it does.
And I have a theory. It's slightly conspiratorial, but here's my theory about why they added definitions. In 2012, a young woman named Snigna Nandipathy won. In 2011, a young woman named Sukanya Roy. In 2010, a young woman named Anamika Viramani. Let Meghna Chakrabarty tell you that it takes more than definitions to break the South Asian hegemony on the National Spelling Bee. You have been told. Anyway, that's my hubbub for today. Scott Lehigh, columnist for the Boston Globe, always great to have you.
Thank you.
And Julie Mahegan, deputy editorial page editor for the Boston Herald. Great to see you again,
as
Julie.
Long as I don't have to spell Chakrabarty, I'm happy to come back anytime.
Meghna's good enough.
And listeners, stay with us. Coming up, a report from Gun Valley, the historical heart of Massachusetts, vibrant gun industry. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.